listening to Radio Arian. At RadioArian.com.
Welcome to Arian Insights. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I'm very pleased to welcome to us today Mr. Harold Covington from the Northwest Front. Harold Covington joined the National Socialist White People's Party way back in the early 70s. He was a founding member of the Rhodesian White People's Party, president of the National Socialist Party of America. The National Socialist White People's Party, I believe he began in 1991, and he is now running the Northwest Front, which he says is the only viable solution for white people in America. He's a fascinating person. He's also an author of many books. He's very well known, and he makes some of the best podcasts available on the internet. So welcome to Arian Insights, Harold. How are you doing today?
Well, I'm able to sit up and take a little nourishment from time to time. Glad to be here.
Well, that's good to hear. Okay, well, I think we'd better start off with a description of what the Northwest Front is all about, why it is the only viable option, and why you picked the Northwest for it.
Well, the Northwest Front is a movement which hopes to establish a sovereign and independent white nation as a homeland for all of the Aryan or white peoples of the earth. And we're going to do that here in the Pacific Northwest in roughly a, right now, 3.5 state area, specifically the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and western Montana. We hope eventually to be able to add other parts of the Northwest, such as British Columbia, Alberta, and Canada, maybe Alaska, who knows? We'll just have to see how that shakes out. But essentially, and maybe this is a bad comparison, but it's the closest one I know, what we do for white people here in the Northwest is what the Jews did in Israel. We are trying to create a, as the liberals would say, safe space for whites here in the Northwest, a new land where we can raise new generations of white people in some degree of prosperity, and above all, in safety and security without the presence of damaging non-whites and Jews and other minorities whose very existence is antithetical to white welfare. We are the ultimate white separatists. The only way in which the white race is going to survive into the next millennium is to separate physically from all of the other non-white peoples of the earth, and that process has to begin somewhere. Right now, we're beginning it here in the United States with the Northwest Front and with the proposed creation of the Northwest American Republic.
That sounds fantastic. How long have you been working at this now? Is it over 10 years that you've been doing this?
Well, I frankly knew, I think in my heart for many years, that this was the only solution. What convinced me spiritually was the murder and martyrdom of the Weaver family at Ruby Ridge in the early 90s. But I, for various reasons having to do with my own circumstances and I suppose maybe spiritual laziness, whatever you want to call it, I didn't begin openly advocating Northwest migration until the year 2000, after what was done to Pastor Butler up here in Idaho. And at that point, I made a personal decision that I would devote the rest of my life to recovering Pastor Butler's legacy and as nearly as possible undoing the terrible wrong which was done to Butler by Morris Dees and by the state authorities in Idaho. And I was going to do two things. Number one, I was going to personally migrate to the Northwest. And number two, I was going to write a novel, because one of my main skills is the writing of fiction about a Northwest nation. and that turned out to be what's called the Hill of the Ravens, and that eventually sort of developed a life of its own and transmogrified into what I suppose you might call the Northwest mythos. There are now 5 Northwest Independence novels, and I myself migrated to the homeland in 2002. The Northwest Front itself was not formally created until November the 5th, 2008, the day after what we call Black Tuesday over here, which was the day when a mulatto Moncoid was elected as President of the United States. And so I suppose, technically speaking, you could say we've been going 8 years, and we have had some success in attracting new migrants to the Northwest, not anywhere near what we should have had. And I've produced a couple more books, and as you say, I produce podcasts, and I basically sit here churning out the message, and hopefully more and more people are going to receive and understand that message.
I like the idea of taking what the Jews did over in Palestine as a model and just trying to get as many white people there as possible and gradually replacing the people that are actually there and forming their own parallel organizations. I think that's a good way of doing things. And you've obviously thought about this a lot and what is the best way to do it. Have you been involved at all in the electoral system since you've been there? I know you've been a member of these various parties, National Socialist parties, over the years, but have you done anything political while you're there? Has the Northwest Front got taken part in the political system at all, or have you despaired of it?
Not really, because number one, right now, the electoral system in America is, for all practical purposes, closed to any alternative viewpoint, be it left, right, center, raving monster, loony party, whatever. Nobody gets in unless they have the cover charge of, you know, $10 or $12 million at least. The American electoral system is now completely and utterly based on a cash register. No money, no pay, no play. And so we frankly just don't have the financial resources to run any kind of serious electoral effort, even if we were so inclined. I am not going to rule out absolutely some kind of participation in the electoral system in the future, but it's going to have to be under a very changed set of circumstances, both as far as what, you know, the situation we find ourselves in and the general situation in the country, because right now, frankly, if you're not a millionaire or you don't have a backing of one of the two major parties, you just don't stand a prayer. It used to be, back when I was doing the electoral thing back in the 70s and 80s in North Carolina as a National Socialist, you could get a little bit of publicity and you could, basically the media would go along with it as kind of a publicity stunt. And I did have some fun running for office. I think I ran for office a total of 4 times back then. But now you're just totally frozen out. They don't even cover alternative candidates. So unless you're a billionaire like Donald Trump, you can't even buy your way in on the national level. So right now, the electoral system in the United States is a complete wash. Let's face it, democracy everywhere in the West is part of the problem and not part of the solution. The purpose of democracy is change, and it's doing so very effectively. So, no, at the moment, no, I have no plans on running for office. I have a blog that I pretty much devote to heckling Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. Basically, it's just for fun, more or less.
Well, yeah, I suppose things could change, and the way that America is being invaded, the same as Europe is being invaded, this may force people to start looking elsewhere rather than the main parties. I mean, obviously, Donald Trump is having some success with talking about some of the issues that are important to us. So I suppose you can't really rule it out entirely, but it's not viable at the moment. Then. People have been asking in our chat room whether you could describe Seattle for them and the surrounding cities, just to give people an idea of what they could expect if they did migrate there.
Okay. Now, it's true that we're forming our own little community here in what we call the Pugetopolis, which is the greater Puget Sound area. Seattle has a reputation as a very super-duper liberal, left-wing, hippy-dippy, granola-type city, and the city itself is pretty much locked down by a local political establishment, which I suppose you might call punching version of the Mayor Daley machine in Chicago. They've got one female blog of some kind who is officially a socialist, and she's introduced things like a $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle, which has had the effect of driving all the fast food restaurants out of the city. And so, Seattle has a reputation as super lefty lib, so does Portland, Oregon, but I keep telling people you should not judge the Northwest by Seattle and Portland. It's true that these cities are so large that electorally they overshadow the countryside, so to speak, along with a couple of other liberal pockets like Eugene, which is the home of the University of Oregon, and Spokane, and so forth. But the Pugetopolis itself is actually a very nice area, and actually one of the problems that new white racial nationalist migrants are running into when they want to come here to the Puget area is the fact that everybody and his dog wants to come to the Puget area, because this is one of the few remaining places in the United States of America that has any jobs. And the result is that there is actually a huge influx of new migrants of all shapes, sizes, and colors coming into this area desperately looking for the last remains of the American good life, because, as I've said, this is one of the few remaining major areas of the country where you can come and you can have some reasonable expectation of getting a job. When our new migrants come here, I can't think of any one of them who has remained unemployed for more than about 3 weeks. So there are jobs here, but unfortunately that means that there's other problems. It means rental housing is sky high. As per usual, we've got all the illegal aliens coming in here, grabbing up every rented room they can find, and so people who come here thinking they're going to rent before they buy a house are, in for some sticker shock. In large parts of the city, the housing is just basically not available. It's nowhere near as bad as I understand London is, for example, but still the squeeze is starting to hit, because there's just too many people wanting. So as much as we like having racial migrants here in the Puget area to join our own little community, when people come to me and ask me about this, I, at the moment, kind of have to clue them in and say, look, this is, especially the part of the area where we live is very nice, but you're going to have these problems with basically everybody and his kid brother trying to come in here. And there is still huge areas of the Pacific Northwest that are, 99% white. What I tell people is, if you have a skill, something that you can do with your hands, if you're a plumber, an electrician, a carpenter, if you are a computer hardware person who can repair and connect and do things like do cable installations for internet and TV and things like that, you can actually get a job pretty much anywhere in the Northwest. If it's anything medical related, you can basically write your ticket anywhere in the Northwest. And there are all kinds of very lovely little small towns, 95-96% white, all over Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and you might want to kind of try your luck there. Also, frankly, if you've got a family, if you've got children, a small town environment is definitely much better than Seattle, well, certainly Seattle itself, because then when the kids get to school age, you'd have to deal with the Seattle public schools or homeschool them or something. And so I'm not trying to discourage people from coming to Seattle itself. We like them here, and the more the merrier, but just be aware of the difficulties. We have had people who try to come here from Europe. It is basically damn near impossible for a white person right now to legally migrate into the United States unless you're a brain surgeon or a nuclear physicist or something, because this country simply does not want white immigration. And I think we're going to be getting a lot of this. I know a lot of British people have come over here, judging from the accents here on the street. I'm not quite sure how they're doing it, but I suspect there's going to be more of an attempt, as Europe is basically overrun by the Turks and whatever those Middle Eastern scum are. A lot of Germans, Swedes, Brits, Frenchmen, people are going to desperately try and get over here. And I think most of them probably aren't going to be able to do it because the United States places such huge blocks in the way of legal immigration from Europe, or white immigration anyway. And I kind of got way off the subject, but basically, Seattle itself, as I've said, is one of the few remaining semi-decent areas to live in, but not even so much the city, it's the suburbs. The Seattle area is a very big area, what we call the Pugetopolis. Basically, it goes from Olympia, which is state capital, down to the south, at the bottom of the sound, up until almost Bellingham on the Canadian border. So it's a very big area, and if you do have money, if you can get a job with one of these big corporations like Boeing or Microsoft or any other, anything like that, get a job offer, and you can get things like help with relocation. Seattle, for all its many urban problems, is still a pretty good place to be. Portland, not so much, because Portland has actually a very large primate population. They've got traditionally black neighborhoods there. They've got branches of all the LA gangs up there, the Crips and the Bloods and that sort of stuff. But anyway, rather than ramble on and on, if any of your readers do want to find more about this, they can check out our website at www.northwestfront.org, or they can email me at nwnet@earthlink.net. That's nwnet@earthlink.net. No. Shut up now and let you ask another question.
So if you're thinking of going there from Europe, you'd have to stop off at Mexico first, get rid of all your documents, and then make your way in illegally. It's terrible, isn't it?
Well, it's insane. Basically, the southern border of the United States has been effectively abolished. Anyone who wants to can walk in right now, so long as you've got a brown skin. If you are white and you try to obey the law and play the game, when I looked into the possibility of getting my Irish wife and children into this country, there is a widespread myth that all you've got to do is marry a Yank and you're, in like Flint with your green card. And no, that's not true. It would have taken almost 2 years for me to take my family legally from Ireland to the United States. When I looked into the possibility of getting my New Zealand girlfriend in back in the early 90s, the INS was set up such that you literally could not speak to an immigration agent on the phone. You had to actually drive all the way down to Charlotte and take a number and sit there all day just to ask a question. And it was just very clear that every conceivable legal blockage was being placed in the way. I don't know if you're familiar with the Heretical Two, these two guys from the UK who ended up going to prison for displaying a Robert Crumb cartoon of all things on their website. They tried to claim asylum over here from Britain's hate laws. I wish to hell they had talked to me about that first, because they did it absolutely wrong. I would love to see someone from Europe or Britain successfully claim asylum here, but the way these guys did it was all wrong. They landed in Los Angeles at the airport, and they walked up to the first guy in uniform they saw, some cop, probably some Mexican cop, and demanded political asylum. And that's just not how it works. That's how the Kaffirs and the Wogs do it in Europe. I understand they just climb the wire, and the first person in uniform they see, they scream asylum. That's not how it works here. The two guys, the two British men, were immediately arrested, and they spent the rest of their stay in the United States for almost 8 months in jail. and until they were, they lost their appeal thanks to a Jewish judge, and they were sent back to the UK, and I think one of them is still in prison now, but the other was let out, and then he got rearrested because he dared to use the internet, and he was back in, you know, Airstrip 1 with the Orwellian police state. So, just a quick hint for any of your listeners over there, if you do intend to claim political asylum in the United States, get in on a tourist visa and get the hell out of that airport. For God's sake, get clear of the airport and get out on the street and get into the population. Then you go and you hire an immigration lawyer. And because you cannot approach the system, the immigration system, in any way, shape, or form and have a chance to win if you're white unless you have an attorney. But never, ever just walk up and ask for asylum in the airport. They will grab your ass up and they will lock you up. And you will never see American daylight. So that, I just wanted to toss that in as a quick bit of advice to some of your listeners in case they want to try fleeing from Britain's hate laws to the United States. I personally think it could probably be done because in most cases, these people have been, you know, arrested and charged in the United Kingdom for things that aren't crimes here. It's just possible that if they had a little bit of luck and a decent lawyer, a precedent could be established that, you know, white Europeans fleeing from Europe's hate laws could get asylum here. I hope so. But for God's sake, if you're going to do that, you know, just smile in their faces, get your tourist visa for 6 months, and get the hell out of that airport and get onto American soil.
That's good advice.
I just want to throw that in there.
No, that's really good. It's a shame this wasn't recorded a while back. We've just had someone jailed for 3 years for a cartoon on the internet of a Happy Merchant Jew cartoon at Auschwitz, and he's just been sentenced to 3 years. So, and I should imagine he was put off from heading for America because of what happened with Simon Shepherd from Heretical and the other chap that was with him. That's who you're referring to. So that's good advice there, because things are only going to get worse with these speech crime laws that we have in Britain. So, I really, really appreciate that, and I'm sure the listeners do as well.
I'm not guaranteeing that it would work, but the fact is it's never actually been taken before an American court to receive a full trial and a full hearing. And my understanding of the laws here is that if someone faces persecution of any kind back in their home country for something that's not even a crime here, it would be very, very difficult to, especially if it's something political and something involving, say, the exercise of what we would consider, you know, the First Amendment, free speech. It would be morally and legally difficult for a judge to send them back. I'm not saying it's not going to happen, but you need to fight the case from the outside with a lawyer at your side, not from inside a jail cell in the Los Angeles County Immigration Detention Center. Okay, anyway, go on. I'm taking up your time.
No, that's great. That's really useful information there. The next one was, what do you have to say to people who are worried that you might become a target there with all white nationalists concentrated in one area?
Well, number one, all white people these days are targets. And I wrote in my last Northwest novel, it's called Freedom Sons, and it talks about the first 50 years of the Northwest American Republic. And I dealt with this objection about, oh, no, Harold, we can never have our own independent country because the feds would just nuke us. I do get this complaint every now and then, oh, we can't concentrate, Harold, because if we concentrate in one place, they'll just come after us and destroy us. We must continue to hide in our mother's basements and tap, tap, tap on our computer. The thing is, that's all there is. The thing you have to remember about the Northwest imperative, Sven, is there is no other alternative if we are serious about white racial survival. The white man in this country, and I suspect in Europe as well, has always been very, very good at finding sound, rational, convincing reasons to do nothing, to let the status quo continue, to do nothing that might cause him personal risk or inconvenience. And let me be blunt, a lot of this bitching and moaning we get about, oh no, how we can't concentrate our forces, it's frankly an excuse to continue to do nothing. It's from people who are basically too damn lazy to get up off their ass and pack a moving van and come up here. I'm sorry if that sounds crude, but that's pretty much the case. It's like, let's say you want to break a window. Now, if you pick up a handful of sand, all those little grains of sand, and you throw that sand at the window, it'll just sort of rattle off harmlessly. But if you pick up a big rock, and you throw that rock, it will break the window. We have to start doing what the Northwest Front is now doing. We have to start creating communities up here in the Northwest to build the kind of infrastructure that we should already have had. I say with some degree of shame that what we're doing in the Northwest right now is what we should have been doing 50 years ago. We are building infrastructure. We are building communities. We are building places where when a white family or a white nationalist comes up here, there is some kind of support system in place. Now, you guys in Britain especially you don't really have that particular problem because, frankly, your country is so small. Usually with white nationalists in Britain, help is only a short train ride away. There are people in this country who have been involved in one way or the other with our little movement for many, many years. They're in their 40s and 50s now, and some of them have never actually laid eyes or conversed personally with another white nationalist because the distances in this country are so huge. One of the reasons that we are so ineffective, is that we are so scattered. So what we're doing here is we're building some people call them PLEs, Pioneer Little Europes. We're building small cells, whatever you want to call them, small communities here in the Northwest, so that we can eventually connect up the dots and have a proper support system for a true revolutionary movement. That has to happen. And we can't do it without everybody reporting for duty, so to speak.
Now, I think what you really need is more people moving there as much as possible to prevent other people getting there. If there are jobs there, people want to be getting there to prevent the illegal immigrants getting there and getting the jobs. And if you've got part of a support network there already, then it should be a big encouragement to people to get there, especially young people who have yet to put down roots. This is who you should really be hoping to get hold of, I should imagine, is young people.
Well, this basically is what the Mexicans, we say Mexicans, basically they're all Hispanics, Salvadorians, Nicaraguans, six of one, half a dozen of the other. But this is what the Hispanics have been doing in this country for 50 years. They've been deliberately changing the demographics and the political landscape. For example, when was the last time you heard of California having a Republican governor or a Republican senator? It used to be a Republican stronghold back in the 60s and 70s. Now, no more because the state has been basically overrun by beaners. So, what the Mexicans have been doing is they've been deliberately changing the demographics. And this is what we propose that the white man do. We deliberately change the demographics by bringing as many of us as possible into a smaller and more workable and manageable area where the job at hand will be doable. What Northwest Migration does, among other things, is it reduces the problem to manageable proportions instead of trying to somehow take over a nation of about 300 million people, which is now over half non-white. We are going into a given area of X number of square miles. The population is roughly between 13 and 14 million people, still majority white, and so that basically reduces the problem to a level where with a small active core group, much could be accomplished. Let's say we are able to accumulate 1,000 what I call Class A's, first-class white nationalist activists in the Pacific Northwest. That's kind of my preliminary goal, get just 1,000 good people up here, and then we're on our way, because then we will have enough momentum to where we can start bringing in the locals, etc. Now, that 1,000 people concentrated in 3.5 states could do some good. You take that same 1,000 people and you scatter them all over across the United States and Canada like grains of sand, and of course they can't do any good. It's not concentrating ourselves as targets. It's clenching the fist to strike a blow. It is concentrating our what little resources we have, frankly, so that we can make a fist. So I understand the objection in theory. In practice, we can't continue to just do what we've been doing, which is nothing.
And you've got to take the chances while it's there as well. I should imagine if anyone has got a chance to come up there and see the place, then they should jump at the chance, to get there and check it out. Well, then the next thing I've got here is people were asking whether there'd been much evidence of Fukushima fallout there where you are.
Not that I myself have seen. We have, one of our migrants here is a retired engineer, and he is very into the Fukushima thing, and he tells me that, number one, apparently that nuclear pile or whatever it is that's over there is still glowing away and polluting everything in the Pacific, and the Japanese government really hasn't done a damn thing about it, and there's starting to be visible effects like, sea life and the Pacific dying out and so forth. It's a shame he's not here, because I'm sure he could give you the whole spritz. I myself haven't seen any obvious, fish glowing in the dark or anything like that, but then again, I probably wouldn't, because the media over here no longer speaks of it. I can't remember the time I last saw either on the web or in the local papers, or I don't watch TV, but I can't really remember the last time I saw any major media coverage of anything Fukushima-related. It's like the whole thing is now officially in the past, and yet I do get these periodic reminders from various little, minor websites and whatnot where various scientists are saying, no, it's not over. Well, as far as migration goes, I mean, yeah, it may well become a problem in the future. We get people coming up with weather-related excuses not to come up here all the time. My favorite is that a lot of people tell me that, well, not a lot of people, some people have told me that they don't dare migrate to the Northwest because they're afraid of volcanoes. I don't know what to say about that. Yes, it's true. Mount Rainier and Mount Hood are, Mount Baker. They're all, dormant volcanoes. And it's possible that sometime in the next 10,000 years, one of them may erupt. Like, Krakatoa. Who knows? But, we can find an excuse anywhere to do nothing. As I've said, the white man is brilliant at that. It's one of the few things we're really good at anymore. Finding excuses to sit back, accept the status quo, and do nothing. Not rock the boat. We've got to lose that habit. We have got to just decide that we are going to solve this problem of race. We are going to solve this question of who owns this continent. We are going to roll up our sleeves, and at long last, after 70 some odd years, we are going to get on with it. And not worry about volcanoes or radioactive fish or Sasquatch coming out of the trees and, carrying away our dogs or whatever other weird excuses we can come up with to not do what we clearly have to do, which is come here to the Pacific Northwest, the land that God or destiny or the cosmos or whatever has clearly decided is going to be the place where we will either live or die as a species. And I'm raving again, but I tend to do that.
Yeah, that's all right. I'd say volcanoes. I think volcanic soil is supposed to be very fertile.
So oh, yeah. Well, this would make a lovely country. This area that we've roped off as that we lay claim to, it's got all of the infrastructure that would be needed for a sovereign country. Above all, it has a coastline with deep water ports. Having lived in Rhodesia, I can tell you that you do not want to have a landlocked enclave surrounded by enemies and dependent on a single lifeline like we had through South Africa. And when that, lifeline was closed off by treachery, there went Rhodesia. So, we have everything we need here. We can produce everything we need. We've got mineral resources. We've got timber. We've got agriculture. Anything that would be necessary for a sovereign and independent nation to survive, we have here in the Pacific Northwest, and we have it largely still unspoiled. I can't understand these cavilling, quibbling, nitpicking objections. Basically, what they're just saying is, I don't want to move. It's too hard, Harold. Oh, I can't do it. Sometimes I want to start, grasping people by the throat and, gently banging their heads against the wall and see if I can rattle around the skull full of mush and knock some sense into it. Anyway, but look, there's no other plan. The idea that we're going to somehow recover all of the United States in one fell swoop and bring back the days of the Brady Bunch, and then, it's over. We can all flop back down on the TV and pick up the remote and, see what's on the tube tonight. Nah, it's not going to work like that. We have this situation now with Donald Trump over here, and in essence, that is the promise of Donald Trump. And as I've said before in my own podcast, Donald Trump is a historical inevitability. At some point, somebody was bound to come along and figure out that his bread was buttered on the side of saying out loud what white people really feel. Turned out to be Trump. I could wish it was someone who was a bit less of a buffoon, but I will say this for Trump. He is saying out loud some things that have to be said, and because he's a billionaire, because he can't be silenced, because he's got all this money and money is power, he's getting away with it, and I have to give him some credit for at least breaking the ice and making certain things that have been unsayable in the past sayable now. That being said, I warn my people over here, if you're going to conduct a flirtation with Donald Trump and go to his rallies and put on his bumper stickers and go, yay, the Donald really told him, okay, fine. We don't really have anything spectacular to offer by way of, that kind of thing. So, fine, off you go, have fun. But don't expect too much. At some point in time, Trump is either going to betray the white man in some very spectacular way, or he is going to be removed from the process. You want to play with Trump right now and have fun with him, fine. Just, you got to understand, he is not the answer. Electing a good white man as president is not the answer, even if it were possible, which it isn't. But the fact is, just one single president with the entire existing power structure against him couldn't do anything, to reverse the decay anyway.
Just something to do as part of a lot of things that people can do. Vote for Trump, move to the Northwest, and start blogs up. Just part of lots of other things I think that people can do. I don't think people should be holding out thinking that he's going to save the day, step in like Superman and save the day. He's definitely not going to do that. Well, the next bit of question I have for you is to do with the framework of governance that you have. You have a constitution and a framework for governance all worked out. But do you have a banking system planned? And if so, what type, what kind, what's it based upon?
First off, again, I have to put in a plug for our website, www.northwestfront, and that's all one word, northwestfront.org. On that website, you can find a copy of the 2006 draft Constitution for the Northwest American Republic. This is a draft. If it is not chiseled in stone yet, eventually when independence arrives, as it will in one form or another, there will be a constitutional convention, and the people who actually win independence will decide what type of society they want, and they will formalize it into a proper constitution. But the draft does contain some things that address that very system, or that very question. Now, you want to know what kind of banking system we have. It does not specify exactly in the Constitution, which was just a draft, but the general thinking of myself and most of the other people who think about this and are thinking about it for the future, it would be something similar to the system established by Helmut Schacht in National Socialist Germany, where there would be no usury, and international trade would be based on a series of trade credits through a trade bank, etc., etc. I don't know if I should go off into this whole...
Well, I think that's the important thing. No usury, I think, is the most important thing of the lot, to cut the usury out from it.
There are certain economic, like in the Constitution, for example, it is forbidden for the state to levy property tax on a homestead, anywhere where white children are being raised. Usury itself is forbidden constitutionally. No bank can, or private individual can charge interest on a loan. Now, that would not prohibit what you might call the Florentine system from the Renaissance, whereby you can, divvy up shares of a profit, but I wrote a long article many years ago called 14th Century Economics Lesson, where I got into this whole thing, and I don't really want to go off on a long Grandpa Simpson-like digression, but the entire international Rothschild usury-based banking system would obviously not be a part of anything to do with the Northwest American Republic. Their banks, like Bank of America or National Westminster, whatever, would not be allowed to operate here. My own personal vision is that there would be a few central financial institutions. I always liked the idea that you had in Britain for a while of a post office savings bank, but I don't know if you still have that over there.
Yeah, I think we do.
The main thing is that we would have an economic system based on free enterprise, but not capitalism. Now, where you draw the line between capitalism and free enterprise is sometimes difficult. My own view is that you've got capitalism when money itself becomes a power in the state, when the tail starts to wag the dog, so to speak, and decisions are not being made by the political leadership, by the legislature, by the executive branch, whatever, but decisions are being made in executive boardrooms, and they then call up the White House or Congress and give them their marching orders. That's capitalism. In the Northwest American Republic, inevitably there would be those who are richer than others, and there would be those who are good at business, and there would be those who create business empires. I have no problem with that, but in the Northwest American Republic or in any white republic, money and capital must be the servants of the state and the people and not their masters. I'm trying to think of some way that I can sum up, my whole economic philosophy in 25 words or less, and as much as I hate to quote a screaming Fabian socialist, I think George Bernard Shaw once said that it is up to society to make sure that the average man has equal protection under the law from both the burglar and the banker, and that pretty much says it. Banking can be a useful service, but under capitalism of the type we've seen in the past 20 years, it's become predatory, and that can't be allowed to happen.
Now, once it stops being a measure of value and becomes a thing in itself, then it just becomes all about making more money rather than producing more.
Well, that is the essence of usury. Money makes money, and nothing is actually produced. In the old days under the early capitalist financial system, I guess you'd call it, capitalism got started when investors, people with money, would buy shares in various enterprises, sending a ship to Constantinople to, buy spices, or building a bridge across the River Arno in Florence, or whatever. But, there would always be something produced or something imported or something added to the economy, actual value in the form of things, be it wool cloth or spices or a bridge or glassware from Germany or whatever. They would actually be added into the local economy. But when you've got, in essence, as a sole trade, then what you've got is money making money. And the ultimate goal of the entire usury system, for those of you who haven't thought it out to the end, has always been something very high on the agenda of the Jewish people as a whole, and that is for the Jewish people to gain control and ownership of all the money in the world. And they are pretty darn close to that right now.
And therefore all the property in the world as well, because money's got to be created in order to buy the property in the first place. It's a huge scam, this usury system of theirs.
They want to set up a system whereby the Jews, in the forms of the banks, own all the money in the world. They briefly lend it to us Goyim so that we can go, spend it on, Cheetos and beer or whatever. But the way the system is set up, it always comes back to the Jews. And the Jews have the ultimate over who gets how much and, for what purpose and so forth and so on. So that right now, I think, is part of the impetus behind these moves in Europe and here to create what they very proudly call a cashless society. In other words, they're going to take away all money and make everybody do things on their debit cards. And that way, full control can be exercised by the system as to who spends how much, and if they don't like something you're spending on, or if they think you somehow got too much money, or they want to mess with you, they can just cancel your card. But they don't like this idea of people having cash and people conducting economic activity outside the usury banking system, which is, one of the reasons they've been so far down on people like these ranchers out west, etc. They don't like independent, self-sufficient Gentile businessmen, the yeoman farmer, you might say, who owns his own land, produces his own food, and is his own master, has always been utter anathema to the Jews and to the collectivist state. The system is trying to exterminate that type of individual. They want everybody working for a paycheck from either the state or from a multinational corporation that can be cut off and used to control behavior and thought and political activity. When everybody's working for a paycheck, the guy that signs the paycheck pretty much calls the shots. And I'm rambling again.
No, that's fine. That sort of covers most of the questions that I had about the Northwest Front. Let's move on to your time in Britain and Ireland. According to Wikipedia, you helped establish Combat 18. Is that true? And what is your opinion of Charlie
not
Sargent?
Not really established. Now, I think more crap has been written about Combat 18 than just about any other movement thing I've ever been involved with. Let me tell you how that happened, and this is the true story, which you may believe or not as you choose. Back in the early 90s, I assume you know who Jerry Gable is and his little Searchlight magazine.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jay Gable is one of these paranoid anti-fascists, and he kind of makes his bread and butter by discovering a new fascist and racist conspiracy every issue. And so along about 92, I think, sometime on there, I'm not quite sure where exactly how it got started, but anyway, Jerry Gable came out in Searchlight magazine with something he called Combat 18, C, which means for 1-8, which means Adolf Hitler, and whether he just plain made it up or whether some skinhead kid made it up, I don't know, but anyway, Jerry Gable took some incident where somebody was getting some harassing phone calls, some Indian shopkeeper or something, and he built it up in Searchlight magazine as this big, huge, latest new fascist, racist conspiracy to conduct paramilitary terror in the UK and blah, 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 blah. And some lads from the Chelsea Football Club saw this, and they decided, you know, there is no Combat 18, but maybe there should be. And so they decided to get together and start, you know, raising various ruckuses, I suppose, presumably on the football terraces, and, you know, punching out Jamaican cab drivers. And, I mean, this is not, you know, the IRA by any means. They were, you know, spraying graffiti all over everything and getting drunk and throwing beer bottles at tackies and this sort of stuff. I mean, this was not, you know, like deep subversive terrorism by any means, but then, of course, Jerry Gable got a hold of that, and it mushroomed, and basically that was how Combat 18 got started. Jerry Gable made it up, and it kind of took on a life of its own, and my involvement consisted of something that Gerhard Locke had done for a while for a group he ran in Germany. Basically, I gave them a United States mailing address where they could that they could actually put on their literature and on their stickers and that sort of stuff in this post office box in Raleigh. And that way, Scotland Yard or whoever didn't have an address that they could go raid. And that lasted for about a year, and then I didn't get what happened. This was 25 years ago. But it was really funny, though, when I was getting mail for Combat 18, because it was at Panorama or somebody had a big, huge thing that Jerry Gable had used to, you know, spin this whole Combat 18 thing into a, you know, big fascist menace and, of course, make money off of it. It's kind of like Morris Deeds does over here. And they had shown the address several times on this show, the post office box, and I started getting some really strange mail because Panorama or whoever this TV show was had you know, portrayed Combat 18 as these violent right-wing white extremists who were, you know, going out and, you know, doing some night riding and burning out, you know, niggers and packing and whatnot in the night and killing Jews and blah, 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 blah. This ridiculous mess. And I would get these envelopes anonymously from some individual postmarked, you know, in Surbiton or some London suburb or Manchester someplace, and say, "Dear Combat 18, there is a Jew who lives down the street from me. His name is such and such. His address is such and such. Here is a map as to how to get to his house." I got a lot of this stuff.
Subtle.
Basically, the locals in Britain, you know, once they got the idea that there was these, you know, lads in ski masks who would come in the night and, you know, do the necessary, they were all in favor of it. A lot of them were anyway. That's why I've always said, if we ever get to the point here in the Northwest where we have a genuine NVA, which if you read the Northwest novels, you'll know what that is. If we ever got to the point where we were conducting a Provost-style, you know, guerrilla campaign in this country, we would have more volunteers than we could shake a stick at. It's just basically a lot of people, they want something done, but they're just not even willing to mess with, you know, passing out leaflets or voting or any, you know, playing on the internet. They want to get it real, and nobody's doing that.
Combat 18, it definitely has a reputation. A lot of people, well, a lot of young people that weren't around when Combat 18 began talk about them. They definitely have a name for themselves. And I suppose, well, that might link in. I mean, the next question was, well, what do you think of rumours that it was a sting operation? But that sort of answers
it,
really.
That is said about everything. I've noticed this, like right now you may have heard about what we got going on over here in Oregon, taking over that wildlife refuge. And anytime anybody does anything in our movement, the conspiracy theorists immediately leap in and say, no, it's a false flag. It's a conspiracy. It's a sting. Stay away. I am not sure whether the conspiracy theory in itself is a conspiracy. In other words, basically this is something that the various state agencies do in order to frighten people away from anybody who, might actually do anything. Because I notice that's something that's always said. The minute you've got any organization that is in any way active doing anything, legal, illegal, whatever, immediately the rumors start circulating, he's FBI, or he's special branch, and above all the messages, you must stay away from these people. They're not what they seem. They're trying to entrap you with this appearance of actually doing something. Stay away from them. Now, you look at, you apply the old tag of, the Roman, statesman Cicero, qui bono. When that happens, who benefits from this undercurrent of no, you must stay away from these people? Or let's say, for the sake of argument, that you've got some group or some individual who really is sincere and who really is trying to do something about the racial or political situation. What would the organs of the state do? One of the first things they would do would be to spread rumors that it was a sting operation or it was a false flag or whatever, to make sure that people didn't, in other words, to spread suspicion, to spread distrust. So anytime anybody does anything, you can expect that you are going to hear that. And a lot of it, of course, also is envy. There are a lot of people in the movement, frankly, who should not be here. And among our many, many problems is people who have egos the size of Mount McKinley, and they literally cannot bear anybody getting any limelight other than them. And a lot of this stuff is simple, pure jealousy. I won't give the man's name, because I'm not going to, start digging up thing, 25-year-old pieces of, rotten bone. But there's an individual who, for many, many years, pursued a lifelong vendetta against me, spreading every rumor he possibly could, attacking me everywhere he could, inciting people to, attack my home and all this sort of stuff, and just on and on and on, just the usual, whole nine yards of movement bullshit. And I was never quite sure why, and eventually, by accident, I found out that it's because when a man named Laird Wilcox published one of these anthologies of American extremism back around the early 90s, he had a chapter on all us wicked evil haters, and I got a picture in the book of me wearing the old costume. This guy did not. And this guy was apparently just so enraged by the fact that I merited a photo in this book and he didn't, that he spent the next 20 years smearing me, vilifying me, spreading rumors about me, slandering me, etc., etc. So I just...
You get some obsessive people about. You really do get some obsessive people about. And it's very true that as soon as people do start getting successful, all the accusations come out that they're a Jew or they're not white or they're an agent.
Oh, yeah.
Or it's all a setup.
Oh, yeah. My favorite about me is I'm supposed to be an alcoholic Indian. American Indian.
I had one about being a magician.
I know who said that, and I have no idea why. But my name is, I'm supposed to be a black magician. I'm supposed to have sacrificed my cat in a satanic ritual in the Nazi headquarters in Raleigh. And I'm also supposed to have sent poltergeists, evil spirits, to haunt Michael Hoffman II. who is a writer over here.
Yeah, yeah, Michael Hoffman.
And and the thing is, we laugh, but there are people who take this seriously. I mean, one of the reasons I always avoided being a fearless leader for so many years after, you know, during my, you know, interregnum in the 90s, late 80s and early 90s, is that I just was tired of the behavior of these middle-aged adolescents. You look at all this crap you see on the internet, not just about me, but about some other people as well. What you have to understand is that in many cases, this is not the work of a bunch of 12-year-olds on a sugar rush, as you might think from the content of these internet posts and whatnot. This is the work of men who are in their 40s and 50s.
Yeah, I know.
It's sad. Bizarre.
Strange.
It's a pathology that I still don't fully understand, even after having lived with it for 40 years. Anyway,
I don't know what you mean there. Well, we were just sort of finishing up. We were talking about Combat 18 and whether you thought that it was a sting operation, but it would seem that it was started by Jerry Gable.
No, it was one of the guys from Chelsea Football Club who decided they wanted to go mess with West Indians and Blackies on the street. And then I understand they got into the skinhead rock scene, and they got into skinhead rock concerts, and money got involved, and that was basically why, you know, what happened to Charlie and other people. Basically, it was disputes over money. I mean, not apparently all that much money, you know, maybe, you know, a few thousand pounds at most, which is a lot of money to, you know, poor, you know, cockney kids from, you know,
disenfranchised white youth
club who never had any.
Yeah.
And it just, let's never underestimate the ability of the white nationalist movement to make utter, total fools of themselves. As I'm sure you know, and your listeners all know who Colin Jordan was. Colin Jordan once said of us, "Our movement has a very big heart and a very small head."
Very accurate.
That largely remains true.
Very accurate. Very accurate. Well, you were in. Come to the next question. You were in Rhodesia fighting for whites against the rest of the white world, as well as against the blacks, and you saw whites fighting against whites once again in Britain and Ireland. So, what are your thoughts on the Ukraine conflict, where yet again we see white people fighting against white people?
Oh, I get into a little bit of trouble over that over here because my thoughts on that are generally pro-Russian. But everyone says, "Oh, but no, Harold, they've got Svoboda and Pravi Sektor in the Ukraine government. Our people are in power in Ukraine." Well, no, they're not. If so, they're in the same cabinet with a Muslim and a Jew. I don't know that much about these Ukrainian nationalist movements. I have looked at some of the stuff from Svoboda and Pravi Sektor, what I can find of it that's translated. There's one of our guys that does know them a little bit better than I do, and he tells me that these are basically big heart, small head. These are basically very sincere people who have one terrible blind spot, and that is that they hate Russians even worse than they hate Jews and communists. And that this has to do with their history. I think I would guess that being ruled as the Ukraine was for almost 70 years by the Soviet state, and with all the incredible cruelty that was inflicted on them, especially under Stalin, which, you know, you talk about your Holocaust, what was done to the Ukraine during the famines and otherwise during the time of Lenin and Stalin in the 20s and 30s was just beyond horrific. It was beyond belief. Starvation, cannibalism, mass murder, the whole thing. And then, of course, during the war, when they tried to revolt against the Soviet system with German help under people like Bandera, and the subsequent retaliation by the Soviets, it's just, I mean, I can understand why they hate Russians. I don't blame these Ukrainian nationalists for thinking the way they do, because very few of us can really rise above the context of our society. But I think they're being used by this Jewish oligarch whose name right now frankly escapes me, who's running the Kiev government.
Yeah, Poroshenko,
yeah, right, okay. And I think they're being used by Poroshenko as street muscle, and they're being used to, frankly, keep the Ukrainian nationalist types from realizing what's going on and turning against them. And beyond that, I just decided that that's a situation I'm not going to pay all that much attention to or pontificate about or rant and rave about, because it's happening, you know, half a world away. Now, it may eventually, of course, lead to World War III, but to me it's pretty obvious what happened. NATO and the United States, acting in concert with the Jewish Mossad, decided that they were going to basically, you know, poke the bear and mess with Putin, and somebody got the bright idea at Foggy Bottom or someplace, hey, let's mess with Putin in his backyard. Let's show that shirtless Ruski who's boss. And, of course, they found out who was boss. But for reasons which I confess I still don't understand, they deliberately decided to provoke a confrontation with Russia and the Ukraine by overthrowing Yanukovych. And I don't know, maybe it was a probe, maybe they wanted to see basically, you know, how Putin would react. Well, they found out how he would react. And so what they did was they made a mess, just like they did in Syria, just like they've done in the Middle East and Iraq and whatnot. And so they've made such terrible messes in those places that they may have decided, well, the only thing we can do is kick over the table. Let's start slinging nukes and see what happens. I mean, these idiots who govern us are quite capable of doing that. But as far as any opinion in general on the Ukraine, I think that what probably will shake out there eventually will be a basically rather fair solution, and that is that there will be a much reduced Ukraine where the Ukrainians will live, and there in the east and down in the Crimea, which are primarily ethnically Russian and Russian-speaking, will go back to Russia where they should be. We developed a very bad habit during the 20th century of, you know, sitting around in big political conferences and international treaty conventions and whatnot, and putting maps on tables and just drawing nice, pretty lines for borders. Well, that looks nice there. Let's draw a border here, and let's have a border here, without paying any attention to who's actually living in those areas. And we're still dealing with it today, to some degree, in the Ukraine. And when the Ukraine, when the Soviet Union broke up, I think it was a case of the Russians just basically didn't have the strength to hang on to those areas of the Ukraine, or that the Ukraine claimed, which were ethnically Russian, Russian-speaking, and, you know, for all practical purposes, parts of Russia always had been. And basically the Ukraine, when it became an independent state under its respective Jewish oligarchs, grabbed things that they shouldn't have had, specifically the Don Basin and the Crimea, etc. And, of course, Odessa is important because it's a warm water port. And so the Russians under Putin are basically finally, after about 20 years or so, rectifying something that should never have happened. And I don't think it's anybody's business. NATO certainly should not be involved. The Ukraine has always been part of the Russian sphere of influence. And no Russian premier or czar or whatever in his right mind with any self-respect or any desire to hang on to his office is going to allow himself to be pushed around to the Ukraine, because that's, like, that's literally on his doorstep. He can't. And so my personal sympathies are pro-Russian, but I have nothing at all against the Ukrainian people. I hope they can work it out and get that Jew out of power, and, you know, maybe some of those guys in Svoboda and probably Sector can, you know, get a little smarts and, you know, start kicking some ass and start doing some things with Kalashnikovs instead of sticks. I've seen them, you know, storming government buildings over there, but they're using sticks, not rifles. You know, so it's street theater.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to have a permanent revolution. You're not going to have change with theater. Anyway, I'm ranting again.
No, that's fine. I think what you're just saying is quite right. You've got the Russian-speaking areas down there in the east of the country, and that is the only really viable political solution that they can come to, is to just leave one area with Russia, the other area with the Ukraine, and Svoboda and Pravi Sector have got to get rid of those Jews that they've put in power over them, really, and establish a true nationalist government that doesn't have Jews and Muslims in it, that has white people in it. I'm sure if they were to make overtures to Russia, you have these bits, if you leave us alone, help us get rid of these Jews in power, then Russia might go along with them, might even help them.
Well, as I understand it, two main Jewish oligarchs over there in the Ukraine are now using their private armies against each other.
Yeah. It will descend into just fighting amongst themselves eventually. Yeah, it's bound to happen with the Jews running it. Well, the next one was to do with Rhodesia again, and also to do with what recently happened in Cologne, where we had 1,000 non-whites going after every white woman that they could find. Now, I wondered whether, when you were out in Rhodesia, you ever heard of anything like this happening?
No.
I mean,
other than the Sharp End itself, the terror area around Mount Darwin, and later on there was another area up around Wanky that was where I got, you know, involved a bit. But other than right up on the border, Rhodesia was one of the safest places I've ever lived. My wife could walk around Bulawayo and Salisbury with no problems. Because the blacks knew that if they stepped out of line, they would be punished. With blacks, it's not so much the severity of punishment that deters them, it is the certainty of punishment. As long as they understood where the lines were, as long as they understood that the white man was in charge and that was the way it worked, there was no real problem, like say, outside the actual terror areas, which were being infiltrated by outside, Chinese and the other communist-trained, insurgents. I was stationed at a place called Llewellyn Barracks in Mata Bailey land that's just outside of Bulawayo. And the actual land was leased from a Mata Bailey chief named Sigula, who had been educated in Europe, I think, at a Sorbonne and the London School of Economics and all this sort of stuff. And usually when he came into, the base or whatever, or the town, he'd be wearing a suit. And, our deputy commander, Captain Naylor, said he would actually, meet Sigolo at some of these little, drinky dudes at the officer's mess. And Sigolo maintained a crocodile pit, and periodically he'd throw a couple of his boys to the crocodiles. Not officially, of course, but, everyone kind of looked the other way, because he was, he was a chief and he was considered to be a valuable asset. And so Captain Naylor asked him once, tell me, Chief, you're an educated man. You've been to school in Europe. You should know that this business of, throwing your people to crocodiles is kind of considered, infradig. Why do you do this? And, the chief says, well, you see, Captain, you must remember this is Africa. Every now and then I must show my people who is boss. And that's how it works in Africa. When the trouble started, both I imagine in South Africa and in Rhodesia, was when the white man showed that he was weak. When the white man showed that he was unsure of himself. That's the one thing I was told by the Rhodesians when I first was over there, and I was sort of, getting instructed by the locals as to how to deal with all these Africans running around. It says, whatever you do, whatever you tell them, always make sure that you sound sure, that you're sure of yourself. Always be decisive. Never ask their opinion on anything. Just tell them what to do, and they'll do it. But if you ask their opinion, if you try to, be their friends, if you try to consult with them or anything like that, they will take it as a sign of weakness. And they will walk all over you, and eventually they'll turn on you. And of course, that's what happened eventually.
Exactly what's happening in Germany, exactly the way that Merkel is treating this and the rest of the German establishment, asking these people for their opinions, showing weakness, not really doing anything about it, covering it up, not telling the news, just emboldening them. I can see this becoming a regular occurrence in Germany. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, let me ask you something. We had I actually had some British guys on my own call-in show a couple of months ago. How are things in the UK right now as far as all these, you know, WOGs and whatnot that are wading across the channel in Calais to try and storm the channel tunnel and run down the 20 miles or whatever, get into Britain? And, I mean, I'm hearing some horror stories from Britain, especially from the London area. But how many of them are actually getting in?
I don't think there's many that are getting in through the channel tunnel anymore. I mean, they stormed it a while back, and I think there was may have been a couple of hundred, few hundred that actually got through. But that was one occurrence. Since then, they've put fences up. Plus, you've got the cold weather now, so I don't think they're as lively as they were before. And it hasn't been in the news very much either. I know that there's a demonstration around that way coming up in a few weeks. So I think that's to support the truckers. I know that the lorry drivers have had more problems than they had before. They've been held up with knives, worried about getting shot. One of them had a novel way of deterring the hijackers by tying bits of pork to the back of his lorry. And in the hopes that would prevent them trying to break in. I'm not sure how successful he was. I mean, this idea of this aversion to pork, I think that goes straight out the window if there's a chance of breaking into someone's lorry by ignoring it. But I don't think it's as bad as it was in the summer. But obviously, it's still a problem. But they made a big thing about that, a big fuss about them coming in through the channel tunnel. But you've got them coming in through the aeroplane, coming in the lorries, smuggling themselves in. You've got drivers bringing them in. We've had that happen a few times. They're more likely to come in the back of a lorry than to actually make their way through the tunnel. They have switched the electricity off in the tunnel before and left the people terrified in the trains, rather than leave the electricity on and risk having a fried nigger, as it were, on the tracks. So obviously, this is the thing that really gets people, is that they worry more about the people invading us than the people that are being invaded. And this is a real bone of contention among all the public, not just among nationalists, but everybody I speak to is confused about why the media is portraying this in the way that it is. It's not portraying the white people as the victims in any way. It is constantly, oh, look at this poor immigrant stubbed his toe trying to climb over the fence, or look at these poor immigrant children. Don't you want to feed them? They're cold. Look at it, it's cold. It's raining on them. Yeah, all of this, it's just sickening to see. It really is sickening. But with the Channel Tunnel, I haven't heard much in the last month or so, to be honest.
Yeah. How can I put this? I haven't actually lived in the UK for almost 25 years. I made a brief visit back to Ireland in 98. But the last time I lived in the UK, I was living in Leighton, and even then London was very crowded. It was very incredibly expensive. It was just, you know, some place that Dan and I were, you know, looking for some way to get out of. But I hesitate to think what it's like now. How can I put this? Is anything in the UK still livable for white people?
Oh, yeah. Rural areas are. It's only the cities that are like this. Where I am, it's all white. We've got two police forces that have got no black police. So they made a big fuss the other day saying, oh, well, we've got to diversify these police forces, but there's no blacks in those areas. So they'd have to ship in Negroes from elsewhere just to put one in the police force. And that, you know, that's the sort of logic behind this. But there are plenty of rural areas that have not become multicultural just yet. So it's not all lost. It's mainly the cities that have been colonized. And the more rural you get, the less you see of it, and the more you get traditional white behavior, talking to people, instinctively knowing what people's body language means, and being able to talk to everyone that you meet, say hello to, good afternoon to, pass the time of day with, all that sort of thing that people no longer have in multicultural areas. You just can't do that anymore. In cities, you can't make eye contact with anyone. Yeah, they would think you were a bit strange if you didn't make eye contact with somebody that you met while you were out for a walk in a rural area. You've also got, in the rural areas, you've also still got the traditions, Christmas traditions, church traditions. You've still got village churches, parish churches that are still full on Sundays. That could do with more people being there. Where you've still got people that have lived in that area all their lives, but they're being sort of pushed out by the prices and with the second homes. But yeah, the further you get away from London and the big cities, the better. And you just don't really see them because they can't survive in that environment. They have to be, they have to have lots of excitement all the time. They have to have the benefits office there. They have to have the council offices there. They have to have everything done for them. You know, they're not capable of thinking ahead of going to a shop once a week. You know, they have to have a shop next door that they can go to spend their money, buy their ready meals, have their fast food everywhere, somewhere to clean up their rubbish. All of these things you don't get once you're outside of the city, and so you don't get these creatures there, thankfully. So I'm very lucky, actually, where I am. But there are people getting together and setting up white communities along the same sort of idea as the Northwest Front, but dotted around the country. There's Western Spring that are doing this, setting up places where you've got active white people. And where I am, I would say it's a passive white community. It's all white, but it's passive. They're not active white nationalists, but I can see that they might well become that way over the next year or so, just with what's happening, because they're all becoming aware of the invasion and what's going on, because they know what's going on in the cities. They know what's happened in the universities. They know what's happening to their relatives that work in the cities that are being replaced by them, that are having to go on diversity training. So everybody knows that there is something up, and I think people are becoming more and more racially aware, and they will do when they see this sort of thing happening that has just happened in Cologne. Because that's, we've already had this thing happen in Rotherham, 1,400 white girls raped. That's still at the back of everybody's mind. And when this thing comes up in Cologne, it comes straight back to them. They remember that, this massacre in France, a month ago. All of these things, you know, are on people's minds. And there's a fury that's, going to be unleashed at some point. It's just rumbling away there at the moment. Just this anger at what's been done, and mainly confusion at why it is happening. How can our politicians be suddenly turned into traitors? Because it hasn't been sudden. It's been a slow build up to this, but to a lot of people, it just seems all of a sudden to them, and really shocking. You've got to really feel for the old people that live in these areas that have been colonized, that haven't been able to move out, and that can't go in the local shop anymore and talk to people about the local gossip, because the local shop has been taken over by Paccies, and they don't speak English, and there's drug dealers outside, and they're worried of getting mugged on the way to the shop. Whereas before, you know, they could go there and get all their news. And the English was a nation of shopkeepers. There are still places where you can get English shops, but most of the cities.
Oh, yeah. Well, one thing I noticed when I was over there, I was in London once. I walked into a little, you know, corner at the back of a shop by a newspaper or something, and there was a white man beside on the counter. I knew it was illegal, I actually was so surprised. I looked up and said, "Hey, you're white." He says, "Yeah, last one, you know, for about a mile." I mean, just like I said, this was 25 years ago in the East End in Leighton, and you did not walk into a small shop and see a white person behind the counter. It just never happened.
I think people forget just what an absolute pleasure it is to walk around shops and have every single one of them run by white people. I think a lot of people have forgotten that. It really does mean something, actually. It's, It actually makes going out shopping pleasant. And we should really get back to this, Harold. Back to the questions here. What are your thoughts on accepting Jews, mulattoes, or queers into the Northwest Republic or nationalism in general?
No. I mean, what you're referring to is called movement modernization. Maybe this is a little conspiratorial on my part, but I honestly think that is something that has been inserted into our movement by some kind of cabal or whatever you want to call it. Probably it was facilitated by the secret fudge packers, but the idea is that the threat. Muslims, it's all Muslims, and never mind the Jews, that's just paranoid, old thinking, horrible right-wing fascism. The Jews don't matter, it's all Muslims, and the queer thing, it doesn't matter what you do in bed so long as what matters is what you do in the street, and of course most people aren't doing anything in the street. It's just, it's an excuse for so-called leaders to, not have to come up to any kind of, decent standards, basically, because, as we as a people degenerate, we get, degenerates as leaders. What can I tell you? There is one individual over there who, in Britain, whom I will not name, but, to this day, cannot understand why he was tolerated as long as he was. He finally got run out of his particular organization, but I don't even think it was over his, proclivities. Anyway. My view of it is, if we're going to accept Jews and queers as members and even as leaders, what's the point of any of it? I mean, why are we doing this? I am told, again, without naming names, sticking my feet into situations I don't know anything about, that some of these modernizers over there with a certain well-known British nationalist group would actually have campaign literature during elections showing themselves proudly with their sons, daughters, and their mulatto grandchildren and their, daughters, black husbands and all this sort of stuff and a big family portrait. I saw that once. I don't know if it happened more than once, but that was enough for me. If we're going to allow that kind of thing, why? Why are we doing any of it? We might as well just, forget the whole thing, go down to the pub and get drunk, like the average white idiots do, because, we're trying to create a better world here. And, buggery and misogynation and Jews calling the shots from behind the scenes, that's what we got now. It is not a better world. That's the same world. Yeah. And I think a lot of it also, I think there is a relation on the part of the Jews to get, white people to do their fighting for them again against their Muslim enemies. Of course, now the Muslim enemies are turning on everybody. But, I understand the European attitude towards Muslims. I mean, over there in Europe, Muslims are the same as Mexicans here. And now, of course, we're getting a Muslim problem, since Obama abolished the border. And, Iranians and Afghans and Iraqis and everything, weird thing from the Middle East is marching across the border just along with the Salvadorians and the Guatemalans. But, if we're going to allow that kind of erosion of moral standards in our so-called nationalist organizations, why be a nationalist? What makes us different from the flipping, Tories?
The whole thing about being a nationalist is ethnicity. It's race. If you're from a different race, if you're a Jew or you're a mulatto, then you have no business being in nationalism. And nationalism, where it's based on ethnicity and race, it's based on the natural creation, natural order. What's right about the natural order? And sodomy is what's wrong. It is going against the natural order. So anything that goes against it, that's no business.
There was a reason that in the laws over here it was referred to as an unnatural act, because it was against nature. It puts a stop to, or interferes with the reproduction of the species, which is clearly against the natural order of things. Nature wants each species to reproduce and to reproduce true to its own kind. Otherwise, you know, we would not have been designed as we are. And when we go against that, when we set up our own judgment against nature or against God or however you want to phrase it, we say, I know better than God or nature what my body is supposed to be used for. Never mind, you know, what made me or why it made me or anything like that. I know better. And therefore, I'm going to do what I want to do, not what God wants to do. And that's, like I say, if we're going to allow that, what difference is there between us and these sheep on the streets? It's one of the, I think, prerequisites for anyone to claim moral or political or spiritual leadership in any cause or in any nation is that the people making that claim have to have a reasonable assertion that they are better than the run-of-the-mill average dweeb, and that because of that, because that they have, you know, certain superior qualities, they are entitled to lead, and they are entitled to tell other people what to do. You can't do that if you're still if you're wallowing in the same, you know, pigsty that, you know, Joe Blow is wallowing in. So, to answer your question, well, it's like Calvin Coolidge, you know, our famous president back in the 20s. He was a man of few words. He came home from the way his wife had been sick and hadn't been able to go to church with him, so he went to church on his own, and Silent Cal came home and visited his wife, and his wife said, well, Cal, what did the preacher talk about in the sermon? And Coolidge said, sin. And the woman said, well, Cal, what did he say? And Coolidge said, he was against it. So, to answer your question, as far as movement modernization goes, I'm against it.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. People say, well, oh, well, if they're supporting us, if they're saying the things we are and saying that they support our positions, well, what's the problem? But they are intrinsically, inherently against everything that nationalism is about. Their very DNA is against it, and their whole character is against it. So it doesn't matter what they say, it's what they do that matters, or it doesn't matter what you say, it's what you are that matters. So I think it's quite an important issue, because there are quite a lot of calls to allow these sort of people in and give them prominent positions, and I think it's entirely wrong. So I'm glad
I noticed you feel the same. For some reason, it's not just members that they say, we must be tolerant of our comrades who want to, you know, commit unnatural acts with other men or who happen to have, you know, hooked noses or anything like that. That would be bad enough. But, you know, somehow it's always leaders of this type we've got to have.
Yeah. That's not setting a good example.
I mean, like, I'm not very big on conspiracy theory, but that whole movement modernization thing makes my antennae twitch.
I think that's a good word for it. Well, it's actually a word. In the next question, I really like the way you use forbidden words. And I was wondering, do you get more people criticizing you for this, or are people more drawn to you because of this?
I think if, rather than my go over that whole spritz on here with you, I would like to refer people to the January the 7th Radio Free Northwest, which they can find at northwestfront.org, and as part of the last part of that podcast, I go into why I use certain forbidden words like nigger and faggot and kike and all that sort of stuff. And there is a reason for it, and I get into it. It has to do with the concept of Orwellian thought control. But as how people react, I find as a whole that I get a favorable response from most people because they don't dare say nigger themselves. Now over here, I'm sure it, well, I know it's bad in Britain. You could probably get arrested for saying nigger over there, but, over here, the consequences can be pretty dire. It's not actually technically illegal to use the word, but in addition to having to watch yourself in public, because, if you say it where a nigger can hear you, you stand a chance of being violently assaulted by a crazed beast. And, number two, if you say it anywhere the wrong person hears you, you can lose your job. And, it's not just, you know, like you can go find another job. It literally, it's one of these things that, it's kind of like an accusation of witchcraft. In the Middle Ages, there is no defense. And, it can, using the wrong word over here can have disastrous consequences. And most people are terrified to use those words, which is why they make an effort to control their thoughts, which is the purpose of banning the word. They want to, make heretical thought impossible by making sure we don't even have the language in our own minds to, you know, to express such thoughts. But, I find that I get, a favorable reaction from most people who admit that they would not dare say it themselves. Every now and then I do get somebody who says, well, Harold, you really shouldn't use such language. It will drive away the better type of person. Well, I frankly never seen any sign of that. I also notice that the people who make that criticism are not generally really helpful to begin with. You get a certain type of person in the movement who wants to come in and explain to you with great patience exactly how you're doing it wrong, and you really shouldn't be doing this, and you shouldn't be doing that, and oh, you have so much potential, but you know, you just won't do it right, and you know, this, the usual Dutch uncle treatment. I call them Dutch uncles. I get Dutch uncle letters all the time. And sometimes they take me to task for my language. Sometimes they take me to task for using, you know, niggerized four-letter words, and there's a little bit more point in that. That is, maybe, I'm kind of horrified to say that a lot of times I don't even, you know, recognize that I've used those words until I play back the recording of my Radio Free Northwest, because these words have become such totally normal parts of conversation in the American, you know, English idiom these days.
I think it's fine using it.
I find generally the reaction is positive.
I think it's good using it with eloquence. You're very eloquent, so when you use them, I think it surprises people. Because people expect, don't expect people with eloquence and a grasp of the English language to use the banned words, which they themselves are too frightened to use. So I think it's very positive. I think it's a pull point to your podcasts. Okay, well, I've got just one last question here now. We're coming near to the end. And that was, do you have any predictions for 2016?
Well, the Chinese have a saying, may you live in interesting times. I think, frankly, it is going to be an unholy mess. I don't think all of this rubbish that started in 2015 is just going to stop and go away. In Europe, the main issue in 2016 is going to be the Muslim invasion, and how, the people of Europe deal with it. And that problem is twofold. Number one, the people, the white people of Europe must deal with the Muslim invaders and somehow find a way to turn them back, and they must deal with their own governments and somehow find a way to get them out of office and get somebody halfway decent in there who will look out for their interests and do things like use the army of a nation for the purpose for which it was intended, which was to protect the nation. Things like that. I don't think anybody's actually called the military out except maybe the Hungarians in order to deal with the invasion. So in Europe, the big thing is going to be the invasion. I think among other things, you're going to experience a total complete collapse of the tourist industry, which is a big source of European income, which I can very well see happening because, I mean, you know, who the hell, if I want to, you know, see a mosque and a bazaar, I'll go to Istanbul and not, you know, not Munich. But, the big issue in Europe will be the invasion of 2016. In this country, this election we're having here, I think, is going to get wild, woolly, and maybe even bloody. I believe that it's possible that either the Democrats or the Rhinos, the Republicans in name only, are going to do anything they possibly can to get rid of Donald Trump, including, if necessary, you know, having him murdered. It's been a long time since anybody in the political system over here has raised such, you know, a ruckus that the powers that be have felt it necessary to have him killed, but I think that time might be approaching again with Trump. Otherwise, the divisions in this country are getting really, really, really bad because you can just feel the government's control slipping. I don't like to be a right-wing doomsayer. I'm not one of these people who says, yes, yes, the end is nigh. I mean, I remember in 1976, when Jimmy Carter was elected president, people were telling me, oh, that was it. The America was finished. You know, by 1978, they'd be doing more America because Jimmy Carter got elected. And I never cease to be amazed at the ability of this system to right itself, to survive another year, another, you know, election cycle. But it's like a slowly sinking ship, but it's level. It's not upending from the bow to the stern. It's just slowly slipping beneath the waves. But now it's got to the point where so much water has come on board that at some point I think it's going to flip up into the bow of the stern. It's actually going to plunge to the bottom. And that could happen. It could happen in 2016. I never used to believe that the balloon would really go up, that the system would ever finally lose its grip and we'd be in the world of Mad Max or anything like that. But now I am convinced it's definitely possible within my lifetime, and the way things are going, it might even be in 2016, because you could, I mean, if you have a sense of history, if you have a sense of the general vibe of a society, you can feel the madness creeping in and the dithering and the corruption in the government is starting to smell. This whole thing with Hillary Clinton and her campaign, it's now, you know, I mean, basically, okay. My guess is that we're going to have Hillary Clinton as the Democratic president, presidential candidate in 2016. She is going to do this despite the fact that she has clearly committed multiple federal felonies, despite the fact that she has betrayed every left-wing, you know, tenet, you know, by helping her husband rape women. And but it's just decided. It's just clear. It's been decided. We're going to have Hillary. And I think that's going to rub a lot of people the wrong way on the Democratic side, because it's just so clear that they're not going to be allowed to have any alternative. This has been decided in the back room. Hillary Clinton's going to be the nominee. In the case of the Republicans, Trump is going to drive these people mad. The country club Republicans, the Rhinos, and they're now talking about a split in the Republican Party if Trump doesn't somehow remove himself from the race or isn't removed somehow. So I don't know what's going to happen there. All I can tell you, Sven, is that it's going to be a wild and crazy ride.
Yeah, I think we can be sure of that. Do you want to just tell people where it is that they can find your work before we finish?
Our website is www.northwestfront, that's all one word, northwestfront.org. And you can email me, Harold Covington, at nwnet, that's nwnet, at earthlink.net.
Fantastic. Harold Covington, thank you very much for being on Arian Insights.
Glad to do it.